This is RÚV English Radio with Darren Adam, daily English language radio from Iceland's national broadcaster, RÚV.
Hello, it's RÚV English Radio. My name's Darren Adam. Thanks very much for your company today. A lot of people around the world, when they think of Iceland, if they don't think of volcanoes or geysers, they will maybe think of the incredible music that comes from this island. And the fact that so much does come from Iceland is all the more incredible when you consider the population of the country. My guest today is going to help me make sense of why that happens, maybe, and also talk about his new book, which describes the history of Icelandic pop music in all of its glory. The book is called Icelandic Pop. Then, today, tomorrow, next week, my guest is Arnar Egger Thordarson, who is here. Even with the font and that title, you echo a Sugar Cubes album, don't you? The second one, I think.
Absolutely.
That's not an accident.
Oh, you're absolutely correct. It's it's a very deliberate reference. Mm.
I want to mention the Sugar Cubes right at the start, because again, and Björk especially, that will be a kind of inflection point for some people. That will be the point where they first, outside of Iceland, heard of Icelandic music.
I call it the year zero.
Yeah.
In this foreign adulation of the Icelandic popular music culture.
Yes. Because I remember hearing Birthday for the first time. And I've been in radio a very long time. I was a volunteer on a radio station in the UK from the age of like 9 or 10 or something. Uh-huh. And the first Icelander I ever spoke to was a phone interview with Einar Ron from the Sugar Cubes. And I'd always been kind of fascinated by Iceland anyway. And so I think that just confirmed the journey that I then ultimately took to Iceland. But that single Birthday, the first time we'd heard Björk's voice, it was an incredible piece of music, wasn't it?
Absolutely. This is a magnificent, can we call it pop song? It has this magical vibe to it. It's almost like a black magic.
Yes.
And strange bass playing, drums. But it absolutely subsumes the listener.
Yes.
You fall for it.
Now, you talked about that being year zero, I guess.
Yeah.
For international audiences.
Absolutely. This was the first band who had a real and proper career outside of Iceland. You know, they were written about in the underground press. They got on the covers of NME and Melody Maker. They did tours. They released 3 albums and so on. Of course, 3 years before, or longer even, was Mesa Forte with their garden party song. And Mesa Forte have an international career as well, but it's a different kind of beast, we could say.
And I do remember, I'd have been about 10, I think, when Garden Party came out. But it was an instrumental piece of music, and it was used by BBC Radio 1, national pop station in the UK, for presenters to talk over.
Yeah. A cracking tune.
So a lot of people ended up hearing, even if they had to listen to DJs, you know, chatting over the top of it, that music was quite well known. And I think I've subsequently, you know, looked back at the Top of the Pops performance, big TV show in the UK with Mezzo Forte performing.
And this was in 1983, and the same year the band Marillion released a song called Garden Party.
Yes, a very different song. But that for a few years would have been the only thing that people thought about internationally when it came to Icelandic music.
I would think so, yeah.
Let's go back before year zero, if we can then, BS, before the Sugar Cubes.
Yeah.
Because, of course, Icelandic pop and the story of it does not start with the Sugar Cubes or even with Mezzo Forte. And you go back in the book, don't you, to the start of what you might think of as pop.
Yeah, 1956 is the starting point. I have a very short chapter before that, Icelandic music from 874 to 1930 circa. But Iceland, you know, being this backwoods society of Scandinavian kings and queens, but Iceland has always been in this Scandinavian mold, we could say, and especially after the Second World War, we get accelerated to modern times. And we get the rock and roll like a blast. And the reason for that is the U.S. Army. And we get a very, we could say, we are able to go behind closed doors, you know, backstage. Because the army has the base and the Icelanders come to the base to play. They get jobs there and they listen to rock and roll through, you know, television and radio. So a fertile rock scene was born in Iceland quite soon. And then we are kind of parallel to all these US Anglo developments in popular music since.
Yes. But going back to that base, there is at the time, isn't there? There's a radio station, a medium wave radio station.
So the signal,
So the signal goes quite far. And at the time, I don't think we're in Roof just now, of course. But I don't think there's only one Roof radio station, isn't there? One radio channel, and it doesn't, in common with lots of sort of legacy broadcasters, doesn't really bring pop music to people.
Absolutely not.
So you've got this radio station broadcasting from the American base in and around Keflavik.
Yeah.
But the signal stretches out to Reykjavik as
Absolutely.
Well. Is that really the spark?
That's the spark, and it's especially strong in Keflavik.
Yes.
And Keflavik is the Liverpool of Iceland at that time. And the figures and characters there, it's incredible how many, you know, key characters in Icelandic pop music are there. And I think there was 1,700 people living there then. That's the spark, that's the, well, the mecca for some years for Icelandic music development, especially in the 60s, when you get Hljómar, you know, the chords and all of that. That's everything is driven from Reykjavik. That's the Beatles of Iceland, and they're very clearly the Beatles of Iceland. They're the kings. There are more Beatle-inspired bands, but Hljómar are the pioneers. They do that kind of music very well. And then they, you know, turn into hippie rock bands and all of that. And it's always this core members of Hljómar, Rúni Júl and Gunni Þórðarson, who lead these things, you know. When Icelanders try to engage with psychedelia and hippie rock music and all of that, and progressive rock, it's the guys from Keflavik who do all the heavy lifting.
Now, whenever a scene begins, there are lots of imitators, aren't there? There are lots of bands that sort of come in the wake of the original band and to an extent copy what's going on. How kind of healthy and how original is the Icelandic pop and rock scene once that spark is lit?
Well, it's almost non-original in the 50s and the 60s. We are very adamant to replicate what's going on outside of Iceland. You know, we're doing these things that the UK and the US are because it's just so exciting. You know, rock and roll is so exciting. It's new and when the Beatles come, you know, there's a craze. In the 70s, we finally get Icelandic pop music in my I term it like that. And we have four strands of it, which is detailed in the book. We get Icelandic humor in the form of the band Stuðmenn from the Menntaskólinn við Hamrahlíð College. They do this surrealistic Icelandic weird humor. We get Spilverk Þjóðanna, the folk pop band, and they do social realism in their lyrics. They're singing in Icelandic about being hungover and getting knots in the stomach because you're meeting the bank manager. Real stuff.
And this is radical, isn't it?
This is radical. This
At
is
that
very.
Time.
No one had sung in Icelandic lyrics about mundane stuff.
Yes.
This is so important. Then we get Megas, the Dylan Cohen figure of Iceland, which is making fun of the Icelandic heritage in his lyrics. This is all new. And then the fourth thing is Þursaflokkurinn, which is led by Egill Ólafsson, and they're working with Icelandic folk music straight into prog rock mold. And all of this, as you say, this is new, this is fresh, this is a new thought.
And it's very Icelandic.
It's very Icelandic.
All of those four things that you mentioned have a very Icelandic feel.
Yeah.
So is that where Icelandic pop, Icelandic modern music sort of splits with its influence?
This is where it's born.
Yeah, yeah.
And imagine, you know, just the importance of hearing an Icelandic guy or a girl singing in Icelandic about stuff you know. It's it's important.
Yes, I want to talk about Icelandic in a bit, but sitting where you're sitting now, just a couple of days ago, and you can hear the show over the Christmas period on Roof English Radio with the brothers Vibe in, and they made a point, and they were proved correct of singing in Icelandic because they said every song that is sung in Icelandic that goes forward to Eurovision qualifies, and the ones that aren't sung in Icelandic do not qualify. And of course, they did qualify. So there's something in that, I think. So we get into the end of the 70s, towards the 80s, and there's a documentary, a musical documentary that is made that lights another fire, isn't there?
Yeah, Rock and Reykjavik. We get two things at the start of the 80s. Yes, in the winter of 81, 82, we get the punk explosion finally. Punk had been, you know, it's a 1976, 1977 thing in the UK and US. It's delayed by almost 4 years to Iceland.
Yeah.
And that's a very Icelandic thing. You know, we suddenly realize, we forgot about punk. We have to do something about it. And people rush into the garages and say, okay, let's just do punk.
Because the rest of the world is doing New Romanticism. It's the Human League and it's Soft Cell and it's Depeche Mode. But here in Iceland, it's punk.
Yeah, and it was, and but we also did that. We condensed 4 years of punk music into one winter. We did the Ultravox thing. We did the basic punk thing. We did the post punk thing. 5 or 6 strands of punk music all condensed in one winter.
Right.
Þetta rættast.
And it was all fine.
Yeah, it was all fine. And so, and then we get the rise of a figure, and I'm trying to connect it to this Icelandic language pop revolution, is of course Bubbi Mortens.
Yes, yes.
And which very soon becomes the king of Icelandic pop and rock, and he sings in Icelandic about Icelandic reality. And yeah, where, you know, he's Dylan, he's Joe Strummer, he's Billy Bragg, he's all these figures rolled into a one. Very enigmatic, no, not enigmatic, I was going to say just a majestic, strong figure. There's nothing enigmatic about Bubbi. He's straight in your face.
But he's very Icelandic as well, isn't he?
He's very Icelandic.
He's got that sense of Icelandic identity, not least through the language, but as you say, what he's singing about as well.
Absolutely.
Nístandi ég Aldrei fyrr séðan Svo hryggan stara Þegar þú kvaddi Hvað ég skildan vel
We're kind of getting close to our entry point now, which is the Sugar Cubes. We're getting to that year zero, but they, through Bad Taste Records,
absolutely,
in Reykjavik, they start to emerge on the back of that compressed punk year, don't they?
Absolutely. We see Björk for the first time really in Rocky Reykjavik, which is singing with Tapi Tikaras. Then, you know, the post-punk band Kukk is formed. They evolve into the Sugar Cubes and so on. And then all this activity is around the Bad Taste label, Think Tank label, Happenings and all of that. And this makes for a very strong underground scene here in Iceland. More bands, Risaeland, Reptile, Ham, and more bands, which are just very active, and there's a need to and wish to try to export this as you can, because people are getting tired of singing and playing for the same 40 people. But it's difficult at this time, and that's later, you know, 10 or 15 years later when the internet is created.
Yes.
That makes for a easier export, we could say.
Who's coming to Iceland at this point? Let's just look through the other end of the telescope for a minute. So in the middle of the 80s or the early 80s?
No one.
Who tours?
Are you talking about foreign artists?
International acts that are coming to Iceland at this point. Is that happening?
Yeah, that is happening. You know, Zeppelin comes in the 70s.
Yeah.
Klass and Stranglers came. We get, you know, regular visits from important foreign artists. That happens, luckily. But, you know, Nick Cave came here to play and all of that. And this, of course, always puts its mark on and inspires the Icelandic artists. So this is, we're not absolutely isolated, but we still have it. And in general tourism, if someone was lurking about in Laugavegur in 1988, people would say, what are you doing here?
Yes.
Especially if he was here in the winter.
Yes. Well, my friend, who I've not seen for a while, actually, Joe Callis, he used to be in the Human League.
Ah.
He did his last ever gig with the band here in Reykjavik. And he told me that he, you know, he comes from a guitar background, but they were a synth band.
Yeah, yeah.
But he wanted to have that smashing a guitar moment. So he smashed one of his synths here on whichever stage it was. I mean, what would have been the biggest venue at that point in sort of 83, 84?
Well, if you were that big, you know, Laugardalshöll hosted this big concerts. But then I was a little kid, or I was 10 years old or something like that.
Yeah, me too at that point, yeah. So we get then to, as we said at the start, we get to the Sugar Cubes, we get to Birthday being released. It makes a lot of noise internationally. It's not a big hit, but it really does, as you say, get all that critical acclaim and people start looking at Iceland. But they start looking at Iceland through the lens of the Sugar Cubes and the kind of exotic nature of Björk, in the way that they didn't with Mezzo Forte, because those guys had mullets and waistcoats and were quite conventional looking.
Absolutely.
There was something otherworldly about the Sugar Cubes, wasn't there?
Absolutely, and ties into, you know, the lava and the volcanoes and all of that. It's otherworldly, as you mentioned. And, you know, the Sugar Cubes do their thing, they split up. But then, of course, the pinnacle year, 1993, when Björk releases Debut, no one was expecting this. No one. People were expecting something.
Yes.
But an artist of that ilk doing that kind of music, which is still avant-garde, being that famous, world famous,
yes.
I have never encountered, and I'm talking about basic musicology here, I've never encountered an artist that is, you know, that weird, in a sense, and that famous.
Yes.
I can maybe think of Beck when he did his song Loser.
Kate Bush is a kind of obvious comparison as well.
Good one. And so you're just, you know, how did this happen? The landscape or the soil was very good at the early 90s, yes. where there was a taste for avant-garde music in the mainstream. So Björk taps into that as well.
But I think as well with Björk coming off the back of the Sugar Cubes, there was zero expectation.
Yeah.
Because the Sugar Cubes had their big hit, which ironically was called Hit.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
And then
absolutely.
The second album happens and the band sort of split up or they, you know, they stop making music and everyone thinks, okay, that's now over. So there was no expectation. She released Debut and I don't think the first single was a massive hit, Human Behaviour. It still sounds
great. Not a massive
hit,
but
it wasn't a huge hit.
But impactful.
But she had the room to grow, didn't she?
Absolutely.
As a solo artist on absolutely her own terms.
Absolutely. It's these three albums post 93, Debut 93, post 95, and then Homogenic 1997. These are incredible albums because they're 90s like, you know, it's the techno pop and all of that. But, you know, her strong artistic stance, you know, shines through everything. And she's, you know, she's this big collaborator. She's working with these magnificent video guys, you know, Michel Gondry and all of that. And it's just an incredible ride. And this, of course, opens so many doors. You know, Gus, the techno band.
Yes.
They are the first band. They were like more like an artistic collective then. They step into these doors. And they are the first band, in my opinion, to do this cool 101 Reykjavik.
Yes.
You know, if I will ever be 10% as cool as Gus were at that time, I'm a winner. You know, they were incredible.
I am in love.
still find the singer of Goose Goose at Eurovision on YouTube, getting no points at all.
So
that coolness was acquired, maybe.
But Daniel August is also a very great Icelandic example of the versatility.
Yes.
A singer range. The range. Gnýdönsk, solo artist.
And going back to Björk and that incredible run of albums, I mean, Hyper Ballad from the second record is my favourite record of all time.
Hey,
without
I agree.
Without question.
I agree.
It is a perfect, perfect record.
Beautiful.
And I did see Björk in Harper a couple of years ago with her, I think delayed because of COVID, concert series where she played songs from various albums. Mm-hmm. And she didn't, when we were there, we didn't see her play the songs from Post, which is just as well, because I would have wept in public if I'd seen her sing and perform Hyperbowl. But anyway. We live on a mountain, right at the top, this beautiful view from the top of the mountain. Every morning I walk towards the edge and throw little things out, like car parts, bottles and cutlery, or whatever I find lying around. It's become a habit, a way to start the day. She also, it seems to me, was at great pains, and rightly so, to point out that women are not just singers. They are composers, they are programmers, they are in the studios, they're pressing the buttons.
Yeah, they're producers.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because that was not obvious at the time.
Yes, she's been a very good fighter in that sense as well.
Yes. You know,
she's been really... she's been fighting the good fight all along. You know, a total artist, I would say.
Yeah. And a whole chapter in your book is dedicated to the domination, the world domination of Björk, and it really did run over those three records, didn't it? Those three albums.
Absolutely. And then I mention her most recent stuff later in the book. But in the same decade, we get the second pillar of Icelandic music when Sigur Rós released their second album, Ágætisbyrjun. And that's another incredible adventure. Mm-hmm. So these two things happen in the same decade, and this absolutely sets the tone for the rest. That in the 2000s, people are always expecting a little bit of a weird music from Iceland.
Yes.
And it's only recently, which this is debunked, and that was made by Of Monsters and Men.
Yes.
With this beautiful quote from Ragnar, the guitar player, when he says, "What's weird about our band is that we're not weird."
This was the first one.
This was the first Icelandic band. It became world famous by playing a relatively normal music compared to what was going on elsewhere.
Because with Sigur Rós, I don't think it's the case now, but it certainly was for years, you couldn't read a review in English about Sigur Rós without hearing about, you know, giant cathedrals of glaciers, the sound of volcanoes, and this is the sound of waterfalls.
Absolutely.
Fine, okay, they are inspired by the amazing landscape here. But let's talk about language, because they invented their own.
Ágætisbyrjun was all in Icelandic.
Yes.
Then they... made this language, Hoplandic. Then they've sung a little bit in English, but mainly in Hoplandic and Icelandic. And that's just, you know, that's what it is. And, you know, it's like an absolute proof of, you know, singing in English to get, to cut through is not necessarily the thing.
Thank you.
What was more surprising to you? Was it the international success of the Sugar Cubes and Björk, or the international success of Sigur Rós? Which felt less likely?
I would probably say the Sugar Cubes. But the Sigur Rós guys are the same age as me. And I was very glad, because Ágeti Spyrjun was a brilliant album.
Yeah.
Seeing music get out of Iceland for the very right reasons. People just could not like Sigur Rós, because the music is so good. Simple as that.
I mean, they are not a band that you would pretend to like for the sake of looking cool, because the songs are all 10 minutes long. So it requires a lot of your time and your investment to enjoy the music if you don't already. Yeah. But of course, so very many people do. I don't want to skip too far forward at this point, but just quickly from the perspective of where we are now, we will go back to the other chapters. As we sit here in 2025, how surprised are you that there is still such interest in Icelandic music around the world, given that we are a country of 400,000 people?
Yeah, I would say I'm perennially surprised. Is that the right word?
Yeah.
I'm constantly surprised,
yeah.
I'm a bit taken aback by this, because the line is undivided somehow. It only continues. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a big interest in the 2000s, and there are always, bands and artists always arrive, which put the focus of the world on Iceland. And the latest example we have is, of course, Laufey.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, then I'm battling as an academic. I'm battling this, you know, what the press wants. The press wants glaciers and lava. They don't want to hear about Sigur Rós being influenced mainly by Smashing Pumpkins and Pink Floyd. That's a story.
Or Brian Eno, you could say, on some of their records.
That's not as exciting as lava and glaciers.
Yeah.
So I also find that interesting. But people are, you know, you look at the world, you look at landscapes, and, you know, I can understand this big interest in Iceland as such, you know, and we've traveled around Iceland, you know, come on. But nonetheless, the activity here in the Icelandic music scene, and that's the sociological explanation I'm going for in the book, the activity is relatively high, and there is an Icelandic situation, you know, this lack of bureaucracy, these ties, this proximity between the scenes and so on, which makes it, quote-unquote, easy to be a musician in Iceland.
Well, collaboration is easy, but it's also necessary, isn't it?
You're right on the money there.
Which is why you get so many people playing in three or four different bands.
Yeah, because you have to.
Which I know makes running a festival really difficult if you're trying to get the bass player from that band to be the drummer in the next band and all that.
Yeah.
But you do end up with a very collaborative music scene, don't you?
And open hearts.
Yes.
If you wanted to see rock in the 90s, you had few choices. So at a concert with a regular rock band, you could see the death metal people, you could see the punks, you could see the regular rock people, and so on. These five, six genres had to watch the rock band, because that was the circus was in town. You had to go out.
Well, there wasn't even a genre for Sigur Rós,
especially
when that second and breakthrough record came out. No one really knew what to call it. No. We sort of landed on post-rock, I guess, you know.
No
one really knew what to call it at the start. And you think of the big acts that have broken through from Iceland, the Sugar Cubes and then Björk, Sigur Rós. Mm-hmm. You could include the likes of Jakobin Arena, for example.
Emil Antorini.
Yes, Laufey that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. I mean, how many genres are covered there?
Quite a lot.
Do you understand people's fascination at the idea of a small country not just generating lots of different acts, but generating lots of very, very, very different acts?
Yeah, I can understand that. And very, very good acts.
Yes.
I can understand that. it's confounding. But somehow it works. You know, Emil Antorini, it's no coincidence that she's as big as she is, because the music is great. Mm. She's a great artist.
And I don't think enough people know that she's Icelandic, actually, internationally.
Yeah, and I can tell you one thing. Of Monsters and Men, the people I talk to, the foreigners, very rarely do they know it's an Icelandic band. Because Of Monsters and Men shot straight into the Billboard 200.
Yes, yes.
So it's interesting.
So we've covered I think a lot of the big names, and we've also covered the fact that the interest level is not diminishing, it's not dropping.
No, it is not.
I think there's going to be a lot of interest in your book, which mm-hmm. is not published until December in the USA, mm-hmm. but it's available elsewhere at the
moment. Yeah, it's available everywhere in the UK and Europe.
And of course here in Iceland.
And here in Iceland, and on all these websites like Amazon, Barnes & Nobles, and so on. So it's if you just look it up, you can very easily order a copy or an e-book yeah. or whatever you want.
So it's available. There, it's there as an e-book as well.
Yeah.
What prompted you to write it?
I was asked to write it by a publisher in the UK called Reaction Books. And it was at the same time I was starting my PhD journey. So that put a spanner in the works for a while. But as I say, I was asked to write the history and spice it up a little bit with sociology. So it's an in-between book. It's like a semi-academic book yes. in a way, but the text is engaging, yes. readable, and it's for the everyman in that sense.
It doesn't take the fun and the love of the music out of the music.
Absolutely
for you
not.
But for you to study it and write about it, it doesn't feel like a job. It's still something you love. Yeah.
I put little jokes in when I can. You can spot them.
Yes. Well, listen, best of luck with the release in the rest of the world in the USA, as I think a lot of people listening will want to grab a copy. And doubtless this will be ending up in quite a few book flood shopping lists here in Iceland.
Without a doubt.
Would be your hope. Do you think that there is another study of Icelandic music to be done in 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years?
Yeah, we need to do more. Now I have an overview book. We need to write more about certain genres. There's a lot to do. I need money. So if you're listening, I need funding for more books.
Okay, well,
thank
listen,
you very much.
Read this one and then commission the next one. And that will be absolutely excellent from my guest today, who is Arne Egan Thoradsen. Arne, thank you very much indeed. Great to talk to you today.
Thank you.
A link to that book, by the way, on the page accompanying the show from RUV English Radio. My name is Darren Adam, and you can get in touch anytime. We are english@ruv.is.
There is more from RUV English, with all the news from Iceland in English at ruv.is/English. RUV English Radio is daily English language radio from Iceland's national broadcaster, RUV.